Thank you so much. That was lovely. I hope you don't stake me out and sacrifice me for forgetting that you were going to sing. Well, did the reading that I did before sound to you like something from a religion class? I'm not surprised. Boston University religion professor Paula Fredrickson often asks her students, what are the major differences between ancient and modern religions? They begin to spin out differences in beliefs, ideas, and values. Most of them believed in many gods, whereas we believe in one or none. They thought that diseases were caused by demons and disasters by stars. We know more today about microorganisms and earthquakes and the like. And then they go on. These answers have their virtues, says Fredrickson. But I do not think that the biggest difference lies in the realm of religious ideas. Ancient Jews were monotheists, but they also fretted about planets and demons. For that matter, certain pagan philosophies had their own form of monotheism. What has changed, altered utterly, is religious behavior. Worship in antiquity involved blood sacrifices. Universally, the worship of a deity, virtually any deity, involved the slaughter of animals and the ritual redistribution of their bodies. Some parts burned on the altar to the divinity, some parts eaten by the priests, other parts distributed to the worshipers. So animals chosen for sacrifice or offering were often remarkable specimens. Maybe they had a special color, a white bull, a red cow, green eggs and ham. Maybe it had to be born or hatched or captured at a certain time of year in some special place or in some special way. You have probably heard that some people even practiced human sacrifice. Sometimes these could be prisoners of war or slaves, but often they came from honored families and spent their lives being treated like living divinity themselves before the sacrifice sent them home to heaven. The point here is that a powerful sacrifice or offering is not usually chosen from surpluses, be they surplus objects, animals, goods, or people. Remember Purusha, he was not only enormous with his 1,000 eyes and 1,000 feet, he was also the only person in the universe yet, unless you count those unnamed gods who sacrificed him on the altar of the earth. The question is whether anything like this persists today, even in a sort of minimalist religious setting like contemporary Unitarian Universalism. How could that be so, when we don't even seem to have an altar to speak of? Are we utterly cut off from the religious ways of the ancient world? Well, my wife Pamela and I have been together for 37 years. Sometimes we pause to consider how we've managed to do it, speaking cautiously so as to not draw too much attention for demons or stars that might put a jinx on our good fortune or punish us for bragging. It took us both years, and this is kind of surprising, to put a finger on one of the things that we hold deeply in common and always have. We might have been married 10 years before we put this together. We said, well, both our fathers came out of an immigrant Catholic background. Poor Irish for her, poor Italian for me, though we were both raised Presbyterian. Big families. My great-grandmother gave birth to 21 children. That's her. 21 children. Of course, they didn't all live. And that's her. Having a large extended family around meant that I had to attend many, many Catholic weddings, communions, wakes, and funerals. There were always cousins or second cousins getting married, great uncles or aunts, or third cousins' brothers dying. No matter how often I went, the services still seemed strange to me. I was at sea, while my cousins all knew how to cross themselves and when and what to do with that kneeler thing in front of the pew. Do we have kneelers? No. But what seemed strangest to a kid who'd been dragged to a Protestant church for a few years was communion. Now, there's often a scaled-down version of communion in Protestant churches. Even the old Universalist church where I once served kept a little communion set in a locked cabinet. Like every minister for the past 100 years, when I first arrived, I was shown where to find the key. That was a ritual. Show the new minister where the key is to the church treasure. We faced considerable controversy at that church when some UU Christians in the congregation wanted to use the communion set during a Bible study group. I'll tell you more about that sometime. Unitarian churches in Hungary and Romania still have communion 4 times a year, when, interestingly enough, attendance always triples. Triples. But it's all small potatoes when compared to Catholic communion, which occupies so much time in church services, much more time than the sermon does if the congregation is big. It also occupies more space. The altar table is placed front and center. It's much larger than the pulpit. When you include the movement of the people from pew to altar and back again, a huge portion of the floor space is involved. The Vatican encourages priests to keep sermons to 8 minutes or less. So why shouldn't the pulpit be smallish and off to the side? Now, by contrast, the pulpit in a Protestant setting is usually front and center and made with more and richer materials than the altar, if there is one. This makes sense. Sermons in 61% of mainline Protestant churches, continuing the theme of religion class today, 61% of mainline Protestant churches run from 11 to 20 minutes. In 27%, they run 21 to 30 minutes. Mine used to be near the top end of this scale, but I've tried to whittle them down over the years. Only 1% of mainline churches have 30 to 60 minute sermons. 30 to 60. Whereas they run that long in a full 27% of conservative Protestant services. Drawing out the name Jesus or Jesus to 3 or 4 syllables probably accounts for some of this time. And you've probably heard about how in colonial America sermons could go on for hours. Mm-hmm. And you may have heard about this. A monitor would roam the aisles carrying a long rod with a feather at one end and a brass ball at the other, so he could reach the middle of a pew to tickle your nose if you'd fallen asleep, or bonk you on the head if the tickle didn't work. I've considered keeping a pea shooter up here to use on sleepers or knitters. I know that knitting really just helps you to concentrate. How can people drift away into dreams or their own thoughts when there's someone up front bearing their soul? Nudity always gets my attention. And isn't this just another form of it? Just teasing. But isn't the pulpit a way of sharing both soul and body? Why not just sit together and read a sermon, or maybe an interesting article on religion or social issues? Wouldn't it be the same? Hardly. Remember that Catholic communion is understood as a way of sharing the actual body and blood of Christ in order to nourish the body and the soul of his church. One God became one man one time only, then gave up his body to redeem the world. It's not so very different from old Purusha giving up his own body for the creation of the heavens and the earth and everything within and between. Even in word-centered religious services, the pulpit does double duty as an altar of sorts. The minister of the word offers her or himself there, often risking a great deal and sometimes losing it all on a single Sunday. Single Sunday morning at that altar pulpit. We've all heard of that happening, and some of us might have actually witnessed it as well. Maybe a minister has come out as gay in support of LGBT people or civil rights, or as a prophetic witness to a host of other truths or causes. And this has proven to be a bit too much for certain churches. The minister may have thought that truth-telling was part of his or her job description. Where'd you get that idea? I do not like it, Sam, I am. Philosopher Paul Ricoeur speaks of bearing prophetic witness as a kind of necessary treason. It's treacherous to commit what he calls such aggression against the security of man when people have enough problems to contend with already. This means that when I hear someone talking about me or someone like me, I want to be pleased and soothed. If I'm challenged, I want it to be not much and not for long. And this means that even in liberal congregations, sometimes a religious leader will take a chance, say something strong, and then discover that the altar is still very much present, and guess who's on it? Ouch! Where's our altar? Do we even have one? Is there any point where the dripping fat has been gathered up like it was from Purusha's sacrifice or in the old temple of Jerusalem? How about right here, right now, burning in the flaming chalice, the symbol of our religious movement? What is it that keeps this flame burning? I participated recently in an online discussion with all the ministers in the Pacific Northwest, both the U.S. and Canada sides. Someone struck a spark by asking if it wasn't about time to replace the practice of passing bowls and baskets for the offering. Why not install a card swipe machine at the back of the sanctuary so people could make their donation on their way out to the parking lot? Oh, bad idea, right? After the service. Well, this got me to thinking. It's not only the pulpit that does double duty today. So do the pews or the chairs. If you've ever explored the Old Testament, you may remember descriptions of burnt offerings and whole offerings. If you've been living a real life in this real world of ours, you know that there are days such words might be applied to you. Sometimes you come in here, feeling burnt by life. Burnt by life. Not much left. By work, by the way things are going in our world or our country. Other days you come in feeling deliciously whole, an abundance of life that you're happy to share. On any given Sunday, these chairs are filled with the burnt and the whole. Offerings on an altar that fills this whole sacred space. How appropriate, then, that we pass a sacred vessel through every pair of hands to make the offering explicit when we pass those boxes, those trays. The vessel up front holds the flame, while these moving vessels collect the oil that keeps it burning. Of course, we use money, which is nothing if not pure potential, more pure than any oil. The candles we light while sharing our joys and concerns represent another kind of offering. The flame is kindled by a child. We then receive it from the chalice and share it with the other candles. Our last candle always reminds us how many more could burn today and of many yet to come. Isn't every offering both a matter of giving and receiving? I shared some of these thoughts with my colleagues. Most affirmed their support for continuing with offering practices much the same as ours, bowl or basket, but no one spoke disrespectfully about the idea of maybe using credit cards instead. Such questions can provoke us to think. They can help us to remember that the great practices of religion, the ancient practices, never really go away. They're as persistent as Sam I am, always ready to shift position and make his offering in fresh, engaging ways. Today, the offering basket helps to sustain a weekly connection. a living bridge between altar, pulpit, pew, and you. Take your time with it. When that basket comes, please take your time with it. It's hot stuff, yeah, but it's not a hot potato. It's green stuff, too, but don't let that make you squeamish. Speaking of green stuff, another form of making connections is our stewardship campaign. It's a yearly form of making connections, and now's that time of year. We know that what most of us give represents a genuine sacrifice, not just a spillover from a huge reservoir of surplus treasures. This is not a congregation of millionaires. Your Canvas team knows that, and knows that you will need to think carefully about what you plan to share. And they want to help you make your decision.